Hi, listeners. Jason here with Joelle.
Hello.
We're really sad that we have to shut down the Psych Health and Safety podcast until January 18, in line with the government-imposed podcast industry shutdown.
So very sad to not do any podcasts for a few weeks. Terrible. But good news, listeners. Jason and I have painstakingly gone over all of the last 70 episodes that we've recorded so that we can choose one favourite episode a week to share with you.
Is three episodes enough to showcase all of our favourites?
This is like asking a parent who their favourite child is, right?
It's tough.
So we have to say no. Clearly three out of 70 isn't enough. I mean, there's some of the 70 that, you know, yeah. But I'm kidding. We love all of our guests.
Mostly.
No, three is not enough, Jason.
Okay.
Should we make it 2 a week?
Yeah, better make it 2 a week. Okay, you heard it here first, listeners. Tune in Tuesdays and Fridays over the Christmas break to hear six. That is six of Joelle and my favourite Psych Health and Safety podcast episodes from 2021.
And we will be back. And we've got a fantastic new episode for the start of the new year with a health and safety heavyweight on January 18th. So stay tuned for that.
Looking forward to it already. On behalf of the team at Flourish CX, we wish you all a happy and safe Christmas.
And a happy new year.
Now, on to this very special replay episode.
From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we'll have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area. But before I introduce our guest and topic for today, allow me to introduce my co-host, Joelle Mitchell. How are you today, Joelle?
I'm well, Jason. I'm well. It's Friday. Looking forward to the weekend. I get to move back into my house next week after 3 months of waiting for it to be repaired. It's all on the up.
Yes. I know. Yes, you have been looking forward to that ever since. I think we chatted before Christmas and you were already in temporary accommodation.
Yeah, it's been since late November that we've been in temporary accommodation. So, yep, looking forward to going home.
Yeah, that would be great. We don't have as early a start today as what we did yesterday.
No, it's a much nicer time zone for us today.
All right, so I'd like to introduce our guest for today. He's now the third Canadian to feature on the Psych Health and Safety podcast. He has considerable expertise in applying risk management to human issues and conducting investigations within workplaces. He was also previously an undercover operative with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. He's the principal director of Veritas Solutions. Welcome to the podcast, Bob Starnhouse.
Thanks very much, Jason and Joelle. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really glad that we were able to connect on LinkedIn and bring the message forth, as it were, around the world. So it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's much needed, and we see you doing good work on the other side of the world, in the other hemisphere. So really great to be able to bring on your expertise onto the podcast today.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right, Bob, let's get started with, we like to ask you a little bit about yourself. What are your favorite podcasts? What do you like to listen to?
Well, you know, I must confess, I'm a little bit old school. So I get a lot of my news. Like, I kind of go to the blogs and the articles and those types of things. But within the context of psychological health and safety, I just love leadership. I just love reading about leadership and trying to be the best leader that I can be. So I would say that the podcast that I do go to oftentimes that actually incorporate psychological safety on them is the Harvard Business Review podcast. And that's where, you know, I've listened to Amy Edmondson on there and some of the other kind of psychological health and safety gurus around the world. So that's probably the one that I would go to if and when I do listen to the podcast. I'm starting to go to listen to them more because I've always been a reader. It's hard to get away from that habit, but definitely it's a nice way to be able to get good information when you're doing other things, driving or, you know, going out for a run or something.
Yeah. What about for fun? Do you listen to any of them for fun?
For fun, podcast for fun. Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think I I tend to have a lot of fun. Fun is a big part of my life, fun and adventure. And I can't say that I've, if you have any that you want to recommend for fun, you let me know.
Well, if you like true crime, there's a lot of, that seems to be an area that people really love getting into, but maybe you've lived that yourself, so you're not too keen on listening to it for entertainment.
Well, you know, interestingly, on a more serious note, I could not listen to or watch true crime shows or crime shows after I left the RCMP for many, many years because of, I've now been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, but I just couldn't, I couldn't watch it anymore because I lived it. And and it took its toll. I'm good now. You know, it's a journey, but I'm good now. I'm able to watch those things and enjoy them as well.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Good to hear that you've been able to move through that. That probably leads us in to ask you then about your professional career. It sounds like a really interesting tale. So sit back, listeners, and enjoy.
Well, thanks, Joel. As we were talking to just before you pressed record, I do use the background of my very unique story in policing as, you know, kind of a launching pad for why I'm passionate about this particular topic. Most of my RCMP career, and for your listeners around the world, the RCMP is the iconic Mountie and the Red Surge and riding the horses and all those things, which you know, it were made famous in the movies and all that stuff, type of stuff. But inevitably, the RCMP is actually everything from a small town sheriff, you know, maybe two police officers in a small town, to a large international organized crime, to anti-terrorism. It's everything. It's very, very broad. So it's a combination of all of the law enforcement agencies you can think of. And so I had a great career, primarily working undercover in Vancouver, BC, Vancouver, British Columbia, on drug traffickers, organized crime figures. I then took a bit of a detour, and I was actually on an anti-terrorist team for 2 years out of Ottawa, and then came back and worked undercover. And there's a technique for your listeners called Mr. Big Investigations. And it's called the Canadian technique, where we actually infiltrated persons that were suspected of committing murder. And we would infiltrate them posing as crime figures, bring them into our crime group, and basically make it safe for them, psychologically safe. That's ironic, isn't it? For them to actually fess up to the murder that they committed. And in two of my particular cases, I was actually brought by the murderer to the body. You know, kind of like how a mouse or a cat brings a mouse to its master to say, hey, look, this is what I did. So I did that for several years. I was one of the leaders on a pioneering team that basically pioneered the technique. And it's internationally recognized, called the Canadian technique. So at that time, what I didn't realize is that I was probably likely at my initial stages of occupational stress injury or post-traumatic stress. And it was really, really a lot of stress, a lot of pressure. And I ended up moving from Vancouver to Edmonton, Alberta. And then I was recruited into to investigate biker gangs. And while also doing the Mr. Big Investigations and also being a part of what's called the Emergency Response Team. So that's your SWAT team, basically. It's Canada's version of SWAT. And I was absolutely in 100% burnout. I was still high functioning, but I was definitely in burnout. And from there, I was very, very frustrated. I got exposed to what I call the politics of policing, which is very closely linked to the budgets of policing. And I got exposed to what I believed, and I still believe, to be unethical and very misleading data that police leaders across Canada were using to get more funding. And I was really frustrated because I said, we don't need more funding to attack and to investigate organized crime. We need to use our resources together. We had so many silos and working against each other and not sharing information and politics, internal politics and turf wars and all the things that you see in an unhealthy work environment we saw at the national stage in policing. And so I ended up I ended up giving some documents to an author who wrote a book. So I was a police whistleblower. Now, the interesting thing about whistleblowing and psychological safety, because it is intertwined. Whistleblowing 22 years ago was kind of a dirty word. No one really knew much about whistleblowing. And now we've got whistleblowing legislation, we've got whistleblowing protection, we've got it's become a mainstream word for truth tellers in the workplace to actually right the wrongs that are going on in the workplace. But back then, that wasn't all that popular. So needless to say, the very senior officers of police across Canada were not happy that the author actually wrote a book and exposed these very ineffective, if not unethical, strategies. And so my career crashed and burned. I ended up getting terminated from my role in the RCMP. But I fought back and I won in both courts of public opinion. So I was on, the front page of our national magazine. I was a subject of documentaries, and I also won my case at the Federal Court of Canada, and I was reinstated to the RCMP. So I share that story in the context of this dialogue because I really believe it's what's driven me now 20 years, some years later, to be a pioneer in this field, in the context of Alberta and Canada as well, because it comes out of my own experience and my own pain from psychological harm, psychological injury, and institutional betrayal, which is all part and parcel of some of this dialogue that's going on.
That's a fascinating story, and I'm sure that there's plenty more detail in there. Something that's been piquing my interest. So you mentioned to us that while you were undercover, you were essentially a hitman, posing as a hitman. So what happens when you're a police officer undercover and the gang that you're infiltrating tells you that you need to go and murder somebody? How do you do that?
Well, every case was different, right? And I use it, as we talked about, Joelle, I do use that as a bit of my hook for some of my public speaking gigs and, hitman's guide type of thing. And in the cases I belong to, so basically, and I'm not telling any secrets that aren't out there in the public domain. I just want your listeners to know that as well. Basically, it's about infiltrating. Someone is presumably, are we okay? We're good? Yeah, someone is presumably looking to have someone killed and find someone that's able to do the job. And we end up finding out about it and then infiltrating that particular person who is looking to have someone killed and basically negotiate, for lack of a better word, a contract, believe it or not. And in one particular case I worked on, which was very interesting, I actually had the person that was trying to hire me to kill his wife, I had him sign in his own signature a contract. And he did. And needless to say, that piece of evidence in the court case was very, very important. But what's even more interesting about that story is I actually had to give evidence at the divorce hearing prior to giving evidence in the criminal case. So his wife, of course, gets told that, yeah, by the way, your soon-to-be ex-husband's tried to have you killed. So her lawyer calls me to give evidence in the divorce proceeding on the fact that her husband tried to have her killed. So I've got all kinds of different stories, but that's just one of them. That's just kind of one of the, so basically we don't obviously follow through. We get enough evidence to support what's called counseling to commit murder. And that's a criminal offense and probably criminal offense in Australia as well.
I hope so.
I'm guessing.
Well, that's fascinating, Bob. So can you tell us a little bit more then about what motivated you to found Veritas Solutions? So you've sort of spoken to that a little bit already.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, after my police career crashed and burned, I ended up, it's funny. I always say this is that, you come to a place in your life where you have a choice to become really bitter or become better. And I chose better. And that includes my education. That includes, mental health. That includes, therapy, everything that we need to do to get better when we have these types of situations. And it ended up, I actually was able to had opportunity to develop and lead a corporate investigations unit in the largest employer in Alberta. So Alberta is our province here in Canada, as you know, and the largest employer was our health authority. So it's the largest health authority in Canada, if not North America. So 110,000 employees, physicians, nurses, everything from everything you can think about within the healthcare system. under one domain, and I was in charge of our corporate investigations unit. So basically, we were tasked with investigating the worst of the worst allegations internally that you could even imagine, you know, all the way from, you know, very serious sexual assault to patient abuse to serious harassment and bullying. You know, we had some of our cases resulted in deaths. And so pretty serious stuff from an internal perspective. So I did that for 10 years. And then in 2018, I launched on my own as a consultant after all the many years of working, you know, in government organizations and for companies as well. I decided to launch as a consultant in this particular area. And I've always been attracted to the safety side of psychological health and safety. And that's really where I focus my consulting, my firm focuses on is on the safety side. I believe in, you know, mental health and making sure that we're, especially COVID right now, and just look after our mental health and how employers can assist their employees from the mental health perspective, the psychological health perspective. But my focus of my firm is primarily on the safety side of psychological health and safety.
Yeah, that resonates with us as well. I mean, it makes sense, right? First, do no harm as an employer, right. And then look at ways to boost it, right? So, yeah. And really, you know, what we want to talk to you today about, and the reason that we really wanted to have you on the show, is talking about psychological hazards and injuries. And we want to talk about how do we investigate these as part of our topic. But before we get into that, can you share some of your observations about how investigations on psychological hazards and injuries is currently done or popularly done?
Just like the whole topic, Jason, I believe that it's an evolution. And what I'm seeing right now is that, so as an example, you know, in terms of how a psychological hazard, let's call it harassment and bullying. I mean, generally you're talking about harassment, bullying, sexual harassment are your primary psychological hazards with respect to an allegation of wrongdoing or allegation of misconduct. Our laws are evolving, which is one of the reasons why, as you know, I know that, one of your guests, Sapna Mahajan, you know, talked about the national standard and the 13 psychosocial risk factors. But that's also, you know, really undergirded by the idea that the laws and legislation are changing to increase the awareness of the duty of care of the employer. So what I would have said 10 years ago on how harassment cases were investigated and handled were, for the most part, very poorly. Because of the, because of the law, because of the arbitration rulings, because of the civil case rulings, et cetera, organizations are starting to realize that if you don't deal with these properly, effectively, efficiently, thoroughly, impartially, that it's going to place you at a lot of risk. Right, more and more people are now, understanding that the law is there to protect, and that we can utilize those laws to ensure that we're protected. And so it has been definitely an evolution. There are some firms such as myself that are kind of on the leading edge of training. I do a lot of training of primarily human resource personnel on how to conduct basically defensible investigations. So I'm seeing that evolution for sure in terms of how to investigate these psychosocial hazards. And Joel and I were talking about that gap. And I think that you have the same thing in Australia. There's been historically a gap between your health and safety professional and your human resource professional. And the idea is to bring them together, right? To bring the best of both worlds and methodologies to make sure that these are done well. And they're done, they're going to withstand any scrutiny because it really is about organizational justice, as you know, from a organizational psychology perspective, that organizational justice is so important.
Yeah, we really do need to have transparency and good procedures in place for these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So we know, I guess, a little bit about how it's currently being done, and we could probably say it's not being done as well as it could be. So how do you go about then undertaking an investigation into a psych hazard or injury?
Well, first and foremost, what you normally have is an allegation come forward, right? That's the other thing, right? You know, from our national standard where psychological health and safety has been defined, I always look to the definition about the that talks about absence of harm or threat of harm, including in a negligent I forget the actual word, it's like reckless or intentional ways. So that assumes that there is someone that is causing psychological harm, right? So that assumes someone's behavior, as opposed to a physical hazard, which could be someone walking, you know, slipping on water or walking underneath a ladder where it's not intentional. Psychological safety assumes that someone is behaving in a way that's causing psychological harm. So how do you investigate it? Well, we start obviously with the interviewing of the persons that are involved, including the complainant. And then we evaluate what's called a prima facie case. So if this was true, would it meet the threshold of the definitions of harassment within our health and safety legislation? And so we look at, yes, it would meet the definition. Most of our definitions, you might be similar. Most of our definitions include the word reasonably be expected to cause harm, right? So there's that word reasonable. And so would it meet that threshold, right? So I always say when I'm teaching on investigations, I say, well, if someone is angry with someone and calling them an F and F and blankety blank in front of all of their colleagues and just yelling and screaming and swearing, would it meet that definition? And everyone says, well, yeah, of course it would. And yet we know that type of behavior still goes on. And so, you know, so we start off with the prima facie case, and then we interview any witnesses, interview respondents, you know, and we oftentimes get a lot of email strings showing a pattern of behavior, right? Harassment and bullying has been defined to be a pattern of behavior, bullying in particular. So we see this pattern of behavior, of harassing behavior that's interestingly easy to deny. And that's what makes these investigations so difficult to actually do properly, is because you're often going to find, you're really going to find someone that's actually engaged in that type of behavior, fall on their sword and say, yeah, you know what? I have been bullying that person. I really don't like them. You don't get that. And so these are really, really challenging investigations to conduct because of that.
Yeah. I'm really interested in that interview process. So you'd have to interview someone who's been the subject of, say, harassment. Is there any difference between how you'd interview someone who has been psychologically injured versus someone who's been physically injured?
Absolutely. I mean, I've done a lot of research and taken training in trauma-informed, right? And I actually teach it on my investigation course as trauma-informed interviewing. And the research out there with respect to harassment and bullying in the workplace identifies the trauma experienced in a psychological injury type of case is as serious as trauma that might be experienced from a physical assault or a sexual assault. And so it's really, really important for an investigator to be trauma-informed, because what is generally going to happen is you're going to have a lot of emotion. Your interviewee might be seemingly a little bit scattered in terms of their recollection, and that's normal and trauma-informed. So you're going to see fight, flight, and freeze in your investigation, in your interview. And you might see all three of those, right? The responses to trauma. You might see all three of those within 1 minute, right? You might get anger, right? You might get fear and I want out of here. You might just get freezing where they don't answer a question. That's all an indicator of trauma. And having, you know, sat with many, many people over the years who've experienced this type of behavior, it is very real. It's not faked. And I challenge investigators to say, well, you know, they poured on the tears and they, you know, that type of thing. So do you really think they're that good an actor? Or do you think that they've been really emotionally traumatized? And say, yeah, good point. Yeah. So yeah. Definitely, I would say that any investigator involved in investigating these types of hazards need to have some form of trauma-informed training.
Yeah. Are there many people who've received that sort of training out there and doing these investigations, I guess, empathetically?
I've taught workplace investigations training now in Western Canada, which I think I'm over probably 1,000 people that have taken my courses, and I have a full module on trauma-informed. So at the very least, they're aware. Then I encourage them to go further and take more training in trauma-informed. Obviously, I can only teach so much in an hour of one segment, but as I said, you know, certainly the people that have taken my courses have at least an awareness of the trauma. Investigators, this is what's really interesting in the investigative world. Investigating a psychological hazard in the workplace is very different than investigating a fraud or theft, very different. And so if an investigator has a skill set to investigate a fraud or a theft, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be good investigators in a psychological hazard, because you have to have that human touch. You really do. And sometimes that's a challenge for some law enforcement that want to go from a career in law enforcement into workplace investigations, and they still have a bit of a law enforcement lens on how to conduct investigations. And you a really good investigator needs to be very, very empathetic. High empathy. The investigators that I bring on that work with Veritas Solutions have high empathy, and I basically screen for high empathy.
Yeah.
So I think coming from a regulator, what I've seen in the organizations where I've looked into complaints of bullying, they'll typically have a threshold of behavior or allegation that they'll investigate internally, and that's typically done through their HR team. And then once it surpasses that threshold, they will typically go to corporate law firms to do those investigations for them. So I guess I wanted to explore a little bit more about that trauma-informed approach that you're talking about there. Is that something that you see corporate law firms thinking about, understanding, sort of training their people in doing those bullying investigations?
I mean, certainly in Canada, one of the leading law firms, I don't mind giving them a shout out because I've really benefited from their materials, is Reuben Tomlinson out of Toronto. And I know that all of their investigators have trauma-informed training, because they do that. That's their bread and butter, is workplace investigations. And so they obviously saw the need for that. I'm going to say one thing. Maybe two. In terms of a law firm conducting an investigation, I have seen some lawyers be able to investigate well and interview well. I have seen other lawyers have very much that legal analytical framework that they're looking at trying to gain evidence, and they're unable to develop that rapport that's required in an interview. That's so critical to get information from people. You have to develop rapport. And so, what I would say that the law firms that specialize in workplace investigations, such as Reuben Tomlinson and some others, they up their game by becoming really good at what they do. And that includes taking interviewing courses. That includes understanding how to develop rapport, how to ask questions in an appropriate manner, and also be trauma-informed. The others that do it off the side, there may be an employment and labor relations firm that kind of do it off the side. I would say that they probably don't have that level of training. Yeah.
And so that obviously then has implications for the findings of their investigation, and that has any implications on the complainant?
Absolutely. Can I give you an example, Joelle? I wrote about it in one of my articles that I wrote. And so I had a case with Alberta Health Services where it was a young nurse alleging sexual violence against an older security officer. And if I didn't know about trauma-informed, I went into my interview with the young nurse, and it was basically alleged that he had forcibly kissed her and not let her go. She's pushing back, trying to get away, and he would not let her go. He had been grooming her, from a sexual predator perspective, as the evidence showed afterwards. But when I went into the interview with the young nurse, she was emotionally absolutely traumatized, a lot of tears, a lot of crying, a lot of self-blame. Why didn't I bring this forward earlier? She missed a lot of dates. Her memory was not good. If I wasn't trauma-informed, I'd say she wasn't that credible a witness. He came in calm, cool, collected, suave, totally like professional, very friendly. And so if you didn't know these types of dynamics that go on, particularly in sexual violence types of cases, if you didn't know those types of dynamics that go on, you would say he was the more credible. But in effect, she was the more credible. And in fact, his credibility, he was a con artist, actually. He had a bogus, fraudulent resumes and all that type of stuff. So on credibility alone, I found in favor that, yes, this happened. If someone doesn't have that level of understanding and training on these types of cases, including in general harassment and bullying, psychological hazard and psychological violence, they may come to an absolute inappropriate finding. And or they might not have the courage to come to a finding because it's a classic he said, she said. So it's imperative that anyone that is really, making this their service that they're providing, that they really need to be educated on the issues and be just like you folks, be on the front end of the spear in terms of bringing this to the forefront.
So I think you've made some really important points there, Bob, and takeaways for organisations or members, decision makers in organisations who might be listening today. For me, a key takeaway there is you need to vet the companies that you are bringing on board to do these types of investigations. You can't just outsource it to your regular corporate law firm if you want to be seen to be taking these issues of bullying and harassment and workplace violence seriously. If this is something that you're taking seriously, you need to choose the right group to do those independent investigations and you need to vet them properly.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, one of my cautions for employers is when you talk about vetting them properly, ask the tough questions. What have you been trained in trauma informed? What do you feel about a he said, she said investigation? Will you be able to come to a finding? One of the challenges that I also see with law firms conducting the investigations is oftentimes it's really confusing what hat they're wearing. Are they there to provide legal advice or are they there to find the truth?
Or are they there to protect the corporation that's employing
them? Exactly, protect the corporation. So you have, if they're there to protect, the legal risks, then on a he said, she said, where it could go one way or another, they're going to find that, no, it didn't actually happen. And so they might come to an unfounded. So their loyalty is not to the truth of the issue. Their loyalty is to their client protecting their legal risks. And I really challenge, I don't mind, I can ruffle feathers. So I don't mind challenging lawyers sometimes and say, well, wait a minute. What's your scope? What's your methodology? What are you actually doing? And as I said, some of them do a great job. And because this is their, basically their service that they provide.
Mm. All right. So that, leads us into asking you then, do you have some key success strategies that you can share for people who want to do a competent investigation into a psychological injury?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing for the employer is, and I'm sure, I know Australian law is very similar because I'm connected on LinkedIn with a lot of Australian investigators. And so the key point on a successful investigation that need to be mitigated right from the get-go is what's called the principles of natural justice and procedural fairness. And so with that comes what's called a reasonable apprehension of bias. And so first and foremost, an investigator needs to be be unbiased, but be seen to be unbiased and impartial. They need to be trained. They need to be experienced, particularly for the high risk ones. If we look at these types of cases, psychological injury on a spectrum, you're going to have your lower end, your lower risk ones, where maybe someone on a bad day, dropped an F-bomb and someone was offended. Has to be investigated, but it wouldn't probably cross that threshold into actual psychological injury. On the far end of the spectrum, you might have your sexual assaults, you might have your threats of violence, you might have physical violence, and anything in between. On those high end, high risk, it's imperative that an investigator approach it from that perspective of impartiality critical analysis, looking for the truth. What's their motive? Like the investigator's motive going in. Needs to be to find the truth as best they can, right, on the balance of probabilities. And without that foundation, usually what happens is as a result of, and I've read a lot of case law in this area, most of the flawed investigations come right back to the investigator. And where the lawyers, have them on the stand and it shows that they were biased. It shows that they were what's called a closed mind. They were closed minded, right? They didn't pass the open minded test. So they were, their biases came into play. Their confirmation biases came into play. So they didn't want to examine other evidence that refuted or supported the allegations. So it is a high area of risk for organizations. When we talk about risk management, it's a high area of risk for organizations to mitigate right from the get-go by using the right investigator.
Mm, okay. And so you've talked about some of the pitfalls that investigators should avoid. Any others that come to mind?
It's funny. When I train investigators, I spend a whole session on emotional intelligence, and emotional intelligence includes bias awareness, right? That self-awareness piece. What's your own triggers? If an investigator, as an example, myself having experienced at a very serious high level, corporate level, had experienced some institutional injury, right? If I haven't healed from that, I'm probably not going to be a good investigator, because I'm going to be bringing in that hurt and that pain into my assessment of credibility, my assessment of what's likely happened. I've seen people that are work in this domain and they haven't healed from their own injury. And therefore, any allegation is deemed to be true. It's got to be true because this person told me it's true. And secondly, it's the big bad corporation that's piling on to the. Whereas as an investigator, I have to go in with open to all possibilities that there's a possibility this could be a false allegation. And we've had those. They're rare. They're not that common, but we've certainly had those. I've investigated those. Or there's a possibility this is a legitimate psychological injury as a result of purposeful psychological harm. We need to be able to be open to the possibilities and start to narrow down to the probabilities based on the evidence. And a lot of that evidence is related to the credibility of the people that you're interviewing.
So I think the psychological term for that is projecting.
Yes, that's right. We're projecting our own stuff out there. And I've seen it on LinkedIn, people that are anti-bullying, anti-workplace bullying advocates. And it's consistent where there's an assumption that any case that hits the news or whatever, there's that assumption of guilt right from the get-go. And as an investigator, I can't do that. Mm. I need to be able to be open-minded to all possibilities.
Great. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah. So, Bob, you've been working in this area for a long time, and I guess you've seen some changes over that period of time as well in terms of psychological health and safety in workplaces. What are your hopes for the future?
Oh, boy. It's interesting. I start my training sessions I start my training sessions, how many people out there, and I just did this last week, I was teaching on our new legislation in Canada, which came to effect on January 1st, 2021. And I said, give me a wave. How many people out there want to work in a healthy, happy, high-performing, productive workplace? So, of course, well, first off, who's not going to wave, right? So, of course, everyone waves. Although knowing what I know, there probably are some that really don't want that because they're not used to that, right? Maybe their whole life has been, drama and stuff like that. And then I bring them on that journey to say, okay, so why aren't we? If we all want it, why aren't we? And it's so complex, as you know, from that organizational psychology perspective where you have conflicts in the workplace and you have, competitiveness and jealousies and backstabbing. And it's so complex. The human condition is so complex. And yet I really believe that legislatively there is the terminology, the zeitgeist, right? There's a zeitgeist right now that is causing organizations to take this seriously and realize that from a cultural perspective, we need to ensure that our workplaces are psychologically healthy and safe. I mean, it's not going away. I tell my corporate clients, I said, this is not going away. Mm. The legislation from the legal lens is evolving. The expectations in terms of what a person should expect in the workplace is evolving. And the other thing is the internet. I mean, the ability for people to expose workplace wrongdoing and for it now at an international level to damage, potentially reputations and liabilities of organizations that don't take this seriously. It's all out there. And like you said, the early adopters are realizing, hey, we need to not only adopt this because it's the right thing to do. First and foremost, it's the right thing to do by employees. But it's also your risk management strategy. And so there is those pressures for organizations to get on the psychological health and safety train. thankfully, and just like yourselves, you know, working in this domain, providing the supports and the training and the investigations and the risk management, we can help, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, what we would like from you now are some parting words of wisdom for professionals who might want to start working in this field of psychological health and safety.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Joel. I've been interested in this because I was on our psychological health and safety committee in my former employer, and it's always been of interest for me, right? And then as I started to delve into it, I realized, well, wait a minute, I could actually get some education and some certifications. So I ended up pursuing two certificates in this area. If someone really wants to be a champion of, unlike yourselves, where you folks have the organizational psychology, which is at that, you know, master's level type of thing, right? But even for the lay person that's working within this domain to get that education, you know, from your certificate. So I'm certified by the Canadian Mental Health Association as a certified psychological health and safety advisor. And then our University of Fredericton in Canada here actually partnered with our Workers' Compensation Board and has offered a significant certificate program where the workers' compensation actually pays 70% of the tuition. So getting those certifications, obviously, it gives you that deep dive in Canada here, you know, the national standard, the 13 psychosocial risk factors, learning all about that and how to help organizations implement a psychological health and safety management system. It's an aspect of what my firm does in terms of consulting in culture, et cetera, but it's also made me and my training a better investigator. Right. So I took the training to be able to offer this and from a proactive perspective, right? Get proactive on psychological health and safety. You don't have to worry about investigations. Right. And yet we're here to offer both. We would much rather be able to go in with organizations and help them be proactive. For me, I believe that psychological safety from a culture perspective is really at its core about leadership. Because everything that I've seen in our investigations or our training or when we go into organizations, it's about wherever that leader is, the leader sets the tone. If the leader is one who is respectful, who insists upon civility in the workplace, who insists upon people not trash talking each other and those types of things, models it, insists upon it, they're going to probably have a pretty good workplace culture. The leader that either doesn't model it and in fact models psychological harm and then either ignores it when it's going on within their workplaces, they're the biggest risk to organizations. At that leadership level, whether it be the frontline supervisor, manager, director, up to the CEO, they're the greatest risk because they will set the tone for what's expected in terms of the workplace. And if we want to increase psychological health and safety, and the laws are telling you have to increase psychological health and safety, then those leaders should get on board and be the champion of psychological health and safety.
Some great advice, Bob. For those of our listeners who are outside of Canada and maybe don't have access to local institutions that offer those kind of certificates. Do you know, do they provide online training?
Yeah, it's all online. Yeah. The University of Fredericton is where I would recommend that they check out. It's all online. They become known as Canada's basically top institution providing certificates, diplomas, and degrees in health and safety, in all aspects of health and safety. I know that I've been one of their kind of poster boys for their course. So they don't mind when I plug it because it is a really, really good course. It's very, very well done and it's all online.
Yeah, great. So possibly something for OSH and HR professionals who are wanting to upskill in this area to consider.
Yeah.
What about yourself, Bob? You've obviously got such a wide, broad experience and expertise in this particular area. How can people reach out to you and find out more about what you offer at Veritas?
Yeah, absolutely. So my website is veritassolutions.net, all one word. And My my personal email is bob.stenhouse@veritassolutions. Where is it? There's my sign. .net, all one word, .net. And absolutely love to, and LinkedIn, Bob Stenhouse on LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn, Jason. I think that's how we met. I saw your podcast pop up. I listened to it and said, this is great. this is important, because I'm not sure that I'm not aware of any others that are going on around the world that are specifically dedicated to psychological health and safety. And so so on LinkedIn, Bob Stenhouse on LinkedIn, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, look, thanks so much for your time and unpacking such a great topic in so concisely and articulately. So thank you so much for that. So that brings us to the end of the show, listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in. Remember, we do video all of these podcast episodes, so you can catch them on the Flourish DX YouTube page. Like Bob, Joel and I are also very active on LinkedIn, probably too active. We probably should be doing other things more productive. But, you know, reach out to us, follow us, connect with us. We're happy to continue the conversation. So that's it for the rest of this for this episode. We hope to catch you next time.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.